This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome back to Radio 314. This is Lana. So I took a couple weeks off, and it's amazing how much different the world can look when you stay offline. Joining me today is Andrus Jones, an actor, musician, writer, and the host creator of Radio 8Ball. Best known in film circles for his role in Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Jones has also toured extensively as a musician in support of his band The Previous. His first book, Accidental Initiations, In the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia, was published by Sync Book Press in 2012. Radio 8Ball is a musical show where questions are answered by randomly selecting songs and interpreting them as the answers like musical tarot cards, and today we'll play that game. Jones splits his time between Olympia and Los Angeles. Hello and welcome, Andrus. How are you today?
Very good. Thanks for having me on, Lana.
Well, I know you've said this about 1,000 times before, but for those who don't know about your show, Radio 8Ball, can you tell us what it is and when and how it came to be?
Radio 8Ball is a pop oracle. It's a musical divination tool where we ask questions by picking songs at random and then interpreting those randomly chosen songs as the answers to the questions, like shaking a musical 8Ball or picking a musical tarot card. Or, I mean, it's something that at this point is something that a lot of people just do naturally. The way that music is delivered to us is in such, you know, in the digital realm now. Is something that we're always listening to music at random, and a lot more people are tuning into the synchronicity of that. But when I started the show in 1998, digital technology in terms of delivering music was just sort of starting, and so we had this show where the idea was to play songs at random, and actually it wasn't even to ask questions. It was, although I guess in some way in the back of my mind it was, because I had always been sort of playing with synchronicity and divination as a musician who toured around the country, and our band would play lots of synchronicity games. We read that the Beatles used synchronicity games, and so that was just sort of like a creative tool that we used. But anyway, I'm giving you a long description of Radio 8Ball's origins, and actually I've never described it quite this way. So
as you said in your book, too, even a crappy pop song can deliver a message, right?
It's true. Well, this is the whole, I started the show in 1998, but I really encountered, I was exploring and working with sync as an art form, but then I discovered all these sync heads, these people who put out the sync book that you're referring to that my book is in. And the whole idea of sync is really, it's elevating the listener to a point where they can, you know, if you have super intense listening, yeah, a crappy pop song is going to deliver God's message in a weird way. You know, in the sense that, I don't know, it's like when you're in love, you can hear a very bad song, and then later on that song will still re-stimulate that feeling of love. Mm-hmm. And if you take that to the next level, what we do on Radio 8Ball, and we started it as a radio show, and now it's a live show that I do all over the country, and we can get into discussing it more. But in a way, I kind of want to just demonstrate it. We talked about doing a little musical divination to start this. And I have, on the Radio 8Ball website, I've created a finite pop oracle that is 78 songs to correspond with the 78 tarot cards. Most of the songs are songs that were either recorded on Radio 8Ball, other artists, are my songs, were artists who have been on Radio 8Ball, and in some cases, some classics who maybe I've worked with or I just felt like had to be in the tarot deck at the time when I made this. And sometimes when I listen to it now, I think, how could I think that card was the Prince of Discs? But anyway, mm-hmm. that's what we'll get. So I was thinking you should ask a question.
Yeah, I've got a question.
You do have a question.
Yes,
okay,
I do.
You have one prepared. Excellent.
It's not anything personal, but it's going to be, you know, for humanity. Let's go for that.
Okay, but, you know, it's always personal. If you're asking.
That's true.
It's always personal. So just to let you know, it's as a warning.
Alrighty. Well, okay. Let's give it a try. My question is, are archons controlling humanity?
Are archons controlling humanity?
That's right.
Oh, wow. Okay. you are going to, I don't know if you'll enjoy this. It's our answer. Well, that was Drink Up, Tomorrow We're Through with me and a band, a local Olympia band called the Mona Reels, that at that time featured one of our local greats, John Merrithew of the Noses, and a band called C Average. On, I think he was on the keyboards, Chad Austinson on drums, Peter David Connolly on the key, on, what the hell was Peter on? I don't know. What was who? Oh, maybe it was John Merrithew on the drums. At any rate, I was playing bass, and that was a song that I initially wrote for an artist named Willie Wisely, who put it out on his record. But this was my version, and it's even his version's pretty pop and apocalyptic pop. But this is the really the real slit your wrist version.
Oh yeah, what year was this?
That would have been, I think, got to be 2003, 2004, written 2000. Actually, more like 2002, probably 2002. So beginning of the Bush era, of the second Bush era, and the you know the Persian Gulf War, and just sort of the in the midst of the apocalyptic maelstrom from you know Y2K to 2012. But your question was about the whether archons are controlling humanity.
Yeah.
And you'll have to explain your question to me so that I can help you interpret it. I think I know because there's a cat from the Sync crowd named Mark Lesperance. Mark. Oh, Alan's going to kill me. My brain's totally going out here. Mark LeClaire. That's what it is. Sorry, Alan. Edit that out. And he is he talks about archons, but I need to know more.
Sure. Yeah, archons are basically, David Icke also talks about them. A lot of people interpret it a little differently, but interdimensional species that are basically feeding on human on the human race, feeding on our energy. So we're like their farm, and they're the ones that are actually behind the scenes controlling things. And that is one of the reasons why the world is in such a mess.
Well, you know, something, it's interesting. I had a friend who was a pretty energetically savvy cat, and he had this whole theory about smoking marijuana, that every time, there was something about the crystals that were in marijuana, that every time you smoked it, you engaged some sort of some kind of portal. You opened up some sort of crystal portal rift, and there were these guardians of this rift who were there to sort of harvest that, or if you were conscious of it, you know, to sort of bargain with you. So like the energetic positivist in me would say that, you know, I was going to say that you can work with, you know, the only reason that these things take advantage of us is because we're unconscious and unaware.
That's right. And that's one of the things I was getting from the song. They're laughing and drinking and they have no idea that the ship is sinking, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's like, if you're going to be harvested by a thing that you can only, like, you have to be really broad-minded to actually believe in it. If you're being harvested by something that's that far out of the realm of your experience, why not just enjoy it? Why attribute a malevolence to it? That, you know, in the way the question is like, are they controlling humanity? You don't know, maybe they're helping us. You know, in a way, it's like, if I was harvesting something, I would probably take care of it better than I see humanity generally taking care of itself.
I don't think they want their food source eating genetically modified organisms, but we've got a lot of those going on.
I know. What's going on with that?
And of course, there's the Jungian perspective as well, right? That this is all in your mind, like you were talking about the unconscious parts of yourself, unrealized, the ways that you get yourself into the hot spots, you're needing to work out your dark spots.
Yeah. And, I guess, to me, the song really is about surrendering to your fate. I remember I wrote the song on the day that I wrote the initial sketch of the song that this is before Willie and I really worked on it and wrote it together. But I wrote the initial sketch for it, which is what you just heard, on the day that we declared that Congress gave George W. the go-ahead to invade Iraq. So it really is about like, okay, well, you get, you know, sort of like at that point in my life, I knew that I had no say and I knew that things were kind of a sham. And at the same time, I did get very passionate about that. I was out in the streets. I was very passionate and I thinking, you know, maybe we could change that, coming out of the enthusiasm that came out of WTO and all of that, and the rage that came out of the election of 2000. And that song is really about, is once you've lost the war, just like, you know, drink up, tomorrow we're through. You know, that's it. Screw the pooch. This is over, you know? So, you know, if you know that's the case, you can get kind of, I don't know, Jedi Zen about it and pony up to the bar.
Hmm. Well, that's a different perspective. I would say based on listening to that song, yes, something is controlling humanity.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. But again, it's like, I would say, yeah, for me, because when I think about it, I try never in the musical divinations to tell someone else what their interpretation is. The exciting part of playing with synchronicity is that anyone who listens to this is going to have a different interpretation of that based upon their relationship to the question, to the tonal quality of the song, to what they like about whatever else, you know, all the other synchronistic things that are going on in their life that we couldn't fathom. But at the same time, what I know from working with sync and is that that it's there, that it's impossible to ask a question sincerely, pick a song and get an answer and then not have something that's unique happen to you about it. And music is powerful. So like I was saying, like you were referencing, it doesn't even have to be a great song. In fact, I think it's the most forgiving way to listen to music. You're investing so much of yourself in it that you start to feel something like it's your own song when it's your answer. And to be able to communicate that as a songwriter into people, some people who are non-songwriters, you don't have the experience of writing their own song, but can have the experience of owning the songs they love and really owning them, because the question makes the song in the realm of Radio 8 Ball, just like the viewer makes the film in the realm of sync film watching. But I don't know if I'm using terms that your audience is familiar with or not familiar with.
Yeah, they'll be familiar with these terms.
Oh, good.
Won't you guys? Yes, they will. They're shaking their heads.
Excellent. So, I mean, you know the Sync Book crowd. Well, I'm sure you have questions. You read my book. It's really, I'm honored that you read my book yesterday on the 2-year anniversary of my beginning writing it. So it's a young book, still growing. But I'm very curious to know what you want to ask about it. Whenever I give it to someone, I'm in part hoping they'll like it, but also really hoping that they don't get really, angry and, reactive to me.
No, it takes me a lot to be offended. I can agree to disagree and not hate someone over it, unlike some other people out there.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I also read, it was on Father's Day, and as I understand, your father was also a big influence in your life, right?
Well, obviously, everyone's father is a huge influence on their life, but he particularly was a huge influence on Radio 8 Ball, his dream seminars that he led at the Evergreen State College in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s, where he and his class would interpret each other's dreams as if they were poetry, just sort of for the fun of it, but also for the academic, that it was it stimulated a part of their minds that lent itself to their other academic pursuits. And, I grew up in a household where that was the family business. So then after my father passed away, I created this show where basically I'm doing that with music. And so clearly there's a connection there. And yes, I do write about it in my book, which is called Accidental Initiations in the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia. It's published from Sync Book Press.
Yeah, and it's part intimate memoir. It includes a little geomancy, some mysticism, cultural myths, self-fulfillment. And you even include a tip for men to practice on how to control their orgasm in a section about tantric art. So you've pretty much tried everything, haven't you?
I have been hewn by life into the monster that I stand before you as now. I've had a lot of different teachers and a lot of different groups that I fell into. And I don't know if you'll remember, but this is going to date me back in the early 80s, there was a Dudley Moore film called Holy Moses.
Yeah, I know the one.
And it's all about this guy who, like, he lives next door to Moses, and he's always on the right on the periphery of where historic shit is happening. I didn't even like the movie that much when I was a kid, but over my life I've thought about it a lot because that does feel like what my life is. It's the book's called Accidental Initiations because my life does feel like, and I think most people's lives are like this if they allow it to be, are a series of accidental initiations. And sometimes we initiate ourselves and sometimes other people initiate us and sometimes we initiate others without even knowing it. And, initiate is really just like to engage.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing more than that. Like when we're just meeting each other, Lana. We are initiating each other into the interviewer interviewee relationship or the, sort of synchronistic fraternity sorority that we are a part of or whatever.
I'd like to go to the beginning of your book because you talk about a Kabbalistic tree of life in Olympia, Washington that basically revealed itself to you and the kneeling Freemason who appears at the intended base of the tree. So tell us how you found this tree and why it became important to you because you use it all throughout the book to correlate it through various events in your life.
Yes, there is a Kabbalistic tree of life that is built into the city of Olympia. And it's not to go too Dan Brown on it because at the base of it, there actually is a kneeling Freemason statue. And it says this is dedicated by the Freemasons of Washington State of every creed and color. And it's very clear, like it's signed. And it's at the base of this structure, a walking structure, not a built up. So like a horizontal structure, not a vertical structure, that is built into the city. And I have been playing and living and being drawn to this park, which is, I think most people who are from Olympia are familiar with it and have probably gone and smoked pot in the gazebo or, walked through it on a summer day or been to some rally there. It's the center of town and has been since there, I mean, it was the site of where the fort was before there was a town, when this was just an outpost in the conquest of the Americas. It actually is marked as the end of the Oregon Trail. So it's this very historic park with a kneeling Freemason at the base of it, and just interesting energy to it. And when I was 40 years old, and sort of at a very weird, I was studying Kabbalah, and a lot of stuff in my life was falling away that seemed pretty like foundational in my life, and this structure of the Kabbalistic tree was what I was meditating on. And while I was meditating on it, I was going out and running, and I would run this pattern in this park. And I don't know, there's a moment where I see it as if it's a movie, where I'm running in it and I'm looking down, and then I look around, and all of a sudden the camera pulls up from where I am and reveals that this image that I've been looking at on the wall is, I'm at the center of it. And all of a sudden, and I'm in this Kabbalah class with all these sort of new agey kind of people, and they're all supposed to draw Kabbalistic trees, and you know, they're making them out of gemstones and different things like that. And I'm feeling kind of like, all I want to do is go out and run this stuff. I don't know why I want to run it. It's like I wanted to sing it when it, like, but I wasn't playing rock and roll. I would have sung it if I was still had a band, but I just felt like I wanted to run it. I wouldn't want to run it. And then all of a sudden, this camera of my mind pulls back, and I see myself. I've got the coolest Kabbalistic tree of life ever. It's encoded with every aspect of my life. My babyhood, I have memories there. My childhood, my, you know, there's aspects of my life all over it. So there's this Kabbalistic tree of life that, you know, and it's, I mean, it's bloody as hell in a lot of ways. And that realization led to a very powerful practice, which on June 16th of 2011 led me to explode and start writing the book that became Accidental Initiations. It was more like a love poem, like not love poem, but like a love rant / suicide note to, you know, to people who would be born after I was dead from old age. You know, like it was just like, you know, and well, you know, just very just an impassioned explosion. And then these crazy synchronicities started happening. And the guy, Alan Abadesa Green from Sync Book Press, was introduced to me by Douglas Bowles just through the internet, and was sold. He was writing this book, putting out this book called Sync Book Volume 1, Sync Book, just Sync Book. And did I have a chapter? And I'm a musician, I'm an actor, I'm a producer of Radio 8 Ball. I've done some freelance journalism, but no one ever calls me to write anything. So the fact that this guy was calling me to write a chapter for a book called The Sync Book, right after I'd had this incredible awakening inside the tree. I should say about June 15th, it was a full moon and a total eclipse, and it was the full moon before the solstice. It was a powerful, really powerful night. And powerful nights in this, these powerful items, you know, you go hang out with at the pyramids at Giza at the right time, and you don't need to take any medicine whatsoever, you know, and the same applies to this. But in this case, I had taken some of the Terence McKenna and so it resulted in this explosion, which was felt within the Sync community and drew me into the Sync community. And it was strange because I was the last writer, maybe one of the last one or two writers to be included in Sync Book. So Alan had been working on it for a long time, but pretty much I sent it to him, and a few weeks later he was in Olympia with a copy of the book. So I was like the last guy on the elevator. And there I was, a published writer. And literally, I had just gotten fired from a job. My life was horrible. It's not that much better now, but it's a million times better because I found this community of the sync crowd that has the kind of creative listening that I've always been writing and creating my art for. And at any rate, so I took Alan on the walk through this tree, and he told me, I told him I was writing about it. He said, well, if you finish the book, we're thinking about starting a publishing house, and if you finish it and it's good, we'll put it out.
Yeah, I thought that your book was basically you're trying to map your own walking the tree of life, all the different phases and all the different correlations. So do you think everyone is going through a sort of ritual drama unconsciously walking the tree of life?
Absolutely. I think everyone is, and until, I don't want to say that Kabbalah is the answer, because I don't know what the answer is. But in my case, what I learned from Kabbalah was something that I learned from a lot of my other practices, my balanced diet of cults, is that there are these energy centers and you can get stuck in them. And the game really is to run the tree. That's why my run through it, having it as a walking labyrinth, is really awesome, because you don't really, when you have that, you walk through it and you get that that's what you do in your life. And you don't want to get bogged down in anyone. And you start to notice, I mean, you read my book, there's one chapter that's very long. That's the chapter where I get stuck. That's the energy center where I get stuck as a human being.
Well, and to draw a good picture of this, the tree of life, it forms a geometric grid on the body, basically consisting of power points or chakras or the sephiroth, right?
Absolutely. Thank you for anything that you think needs clarifying, please do, because you gave me free license to just talk as if everyone gets it. More questions.
Yeah, so how can this tree of life help in self-understanding? Where did it come from, this idea?
Well, I'm really not qualified. Anything I say on that is sort of secondhand. The idea of the Kabbalah is something that I encourage people to study. It is powerful, and I hope that you find a really good teacher in that regard. For me, just what I would say to, and this book is written for people who are not particularly Kabbalah scholars, but people who are, it's in a way a little travel guidebook for people who visit Olympia, is there's this Kabbalistic tree of life. Here I'm going to lay it out. This is what happened to me when I lived around it. It's very powerful. Go for a walk in it and see what happens. It is a map of consciousness, and it's very well balanced, and it exists. And so why not use it? Again, if you happen to grow up next to one of the pyramids that, you know, create a supposed network on the earth that predates modern civilization, well, then you're lucky to, you know, to be able to participate in that. Mm-hmm. And you should use it. Just like if you're next to a waterfall, use it. You know, these are, except these are consciously made items left behind as artwork. And what's interesting, very interesting about the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia is that it's not like it's this ancient thing that was placed there to be the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and then it just sort of happens to be there. Ever since 1976, since the bicentennial, there have been additions to the park, little improvements, little tweaks here and there, and each one has brought this particular walking labyrinth more in alignment with the Kabbalistic Tree of Life than it was before, and very much so after the millennium, when they built in a big mound right where, I'm going to get Kabbalah-y on you, where Chokhmah is, and a swirl, a sort of a yin swirl, Fibonacci swirl, where Bina would be, and they are the Sephirot that bookend or bridge the abyss, Da'at. And, you know, one is the sort of masculine swirl, and one is the feminine, and they're above, one is at the top of the masculine pillar in the Tree of Life, and one is above the feminine pillar. And that's just been put in since 2000. And so one of the things, I'm not interested in detective work. I'm kind of curious for someone else to be a detective and figure out if this is intentional. But my feeling is, if it's not intentional, then life is so much more magical than I even want to begin to fathom, mm-hmm. that it's easier to think that, like, someone's, you know, keeping this going.
Well, in your book, you say, I'm going to read a little section. Welcome to the world of 21st century geomancy, as prophesied by art activist and former Evergreen professor Jose Arguelles in his 1988 book Earth Ascending. We are realigning with the sacred artifacts of our Earth-wise ancestors. In doing so, we are bringing these artifacts to life and ourselves into alignment with their energies.
Absolutely. God, you know, it's not bad. It's not bad. I any art you create when you're this close to it, only 2 years out, I really wish I had written a better book. But it wasn't about writing a good book. It was about writing a very honest book that was that seemed genuinely inspired. And I will never do anything like it again. It's very embarrassing. And like you say, I think you said before the interview, you feel like you know me very well, but it doesn't work as a cautionary tale. It's like, you know,
it never does. You can tell someone, warn them a million times that until they go through it, it's not going to soak their head, you know?
Well, I guess that's it. It's not so much that it's just saying that this is true. And in order for me to let you know that this is true and have it resonate with your truth, I have to be totally honest in what I'm saying. Even to the point of, you know, even I'm saying that about that book, there's a way that that book is the ways it's dishonest are honest, if I could say. I don't know if that makes sense. Anyway, it was nice to hear you read it. You read it very nicely.
You also have a section of the book that explains a balanced diet of cults, which I liked. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I've had many different teachers. I've fallen in with many different crowds. And some of the teachers have been what you would think of as sacred, like, I don't know, Buddhist monks or, you know, inspirational people with a lineage that they come from. And some of it's, you know, might think of as profane, like rock and roll or movies or, you know, culture or practices, sacred and profane. And at a certain point, I realized that I had developed this balanced diet of cults where I kind of had a different, like, I could accommodate almost any philosophy as long as I could find the consciousness located in my body, which is something I learned from the Tantra cult, which is really good for the root and second chakra. Also pretty good for the crown chakra. So it's like good for uniting those. It's Tantra Buddhism, kind of good for all the chakras, but there are some that are more resonant with particular ones. A lot of Judeo-Christian, I say light for Christianity, but I kind of think it's just like a Judeo-Christian thing, that it's very heart and mind centered, which is good for certain things and not good for other things. You know, it's just, no, and they're good to go to, like the supreme forgiveness of Jesus is awesome. It's very super heart, super, super heart energy. And that fills all the other chakras in a certain way. But, you know, what Christianity also resonates and is attracted to itself is a lot of body haters. And so that's not really great if you want to have an intimate relationship with another human being, unless it really is that pure heart thing. But that pure, you know, you have to take, as a synchronistic, you have to take things as they are. And the truth is that the whole Judeo-Christian thing has so much, you know, it's just got so much blood on it. I mean, all these religions do, but but the particular kind of, I don't know, just awful sex-hating, you know, witch-burning thing that a lot of the patriarchal religions have connected to them they're disquieting, to say the least. But they're around us, so you take them, you take what you can from it and leave the rest. Sort of a thing that I learned as an actor. You know, use whatever you can to do the role that's in front of you. And sometimes I can, you know, it's great. It's my job to be really humble, and I can use the philosophy that gets me there. And sometimes it's my job, like in this interview, to just totally talk my ass off and dominate and act like I'm kind of important. And then it's important for me not, you know, to know which philosophy and which cult, which teaching, which practice fulfills and helps me to get to do that job.
Mm-hmm. And today, don't you find that our pop culture is all about feeding the root chakra? That's all out of balance if you look around.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm part of a, I think Sync is part of a pop culture movement that is really aimed at the third eye in a big way, in a really powerful and important and an initiatory way. And films like Room 237 or, I don't know, just interesting, I don't know, shows like Dan Harmon's Community or, I don't know, other sort of mind-twistingly humorous expressions of pop culture are, you know, there are intelligent stuff. You're right. Most of the, you know, I'm sure porn is the most popular thing on the internet. But aside from, I think that has more to do with the fact that it's the only, like, that there is still a lot of shame out in the world and people are still, like, sort of hiding their sexuality in, you know, private little boxes and screens. But at the same time, we're finding out there is no privacy. So all that private, ritual that people think they've been doing is not private at all. It's well documented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great because in a way, nobody will ever be able to be blackmailed for masturbating again, because everybody.
But it seems like people are happy to volunteer all this information and put it out there.
I don't know if people are happy. I think people are. It goes back to your question. People are resigned to not having control. I think that started with the election. For me, it really started with the election of 2000. When that happened, it was so clear that things could happen in front of us in plain sight and nothing would get done about it. And maybe that was just my naivete leading up to that point, but I don't think I've been that naive up to that. I'd already been through the Persian Gulf War I, and been through being a sort of moderate little Hollywood actor and see a little bit behind the curtain of how things work. But still, 2000 was huge. I don't know if it was for you. I feel like it was. I think it was a big turning point for the country. But I've waded away from my book and out of my expertise.
No, it's okay. I wanted to ask you though: have you analyzed or interpreted the films you've acted in?
Well,
any syncs or messages?
I'm really glad you asked that, because I always had a sense that there was something going on there, but I didn't know what it was. And then Will Morgan, who is one of the characters from Sync Book who I met, he interviewed me for a show called 42 Minutes that he does with Douglas Bowles on Sync Book Radio. And he got kind of obsessed with finding the syncs in my films. And what he's done over the last year, well, first of all, he made a film called Psychocinematic Analysis that connected the syncs of my being in the Dream Nightmare on Elm Street, the Dream Master, with my father's work about dreams, and that connecting to Radio 8 Ball and my work with Radio 8 Ball, and other weird syncs like my working with Viggo Mortensen, and sort of that's one of my Holy Moses things. I got Viggo as agent. We worked on this crappy little B movie. I don't know who Viggo, if you know who Viggo is. He's King Aragorn in Lord of the Rings, and David Cronenberg's sort of the Robert De Niro to David Cronenberg's Martin Scorsese. Forgive me if I get a little bit movie heavy on this.
No, that's all right.
Again, let me know if I need to, you know, explain anything. But so he honed in on that, and that was it was this weird, rough work. It felt like, as I said at the time, it felt sort of like having your brain operated on while you're awake. It did sort of rewire my brain in some certain ways and make me see syncs in my films in a very personal way that I had always kind of suspected, but it takes someone else to show it to you, because it would really be, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't even know how to go about trying to explain that to someone, and Will did. And then he and I started to work on films about other actors. with me narrating and sort of helping out a little bit with the writing, and him creating films for different actors. And I had already experimented with this with having Jake Kotza, who's probably been on this network as well, doing films for some of the actors who have been on Radio 8 Ball, like Seth Green and John C. Reilly and Radon Chong, and you know, a lot of other people. And Patricia Arquette was another one. And now, having done that, Will has started on a series, really exploring these different themes of sync that show up in my films. And it's such a strange process working on this. In some ways, it's very pleasurable to my ego. In some ways, it's very challenging to my ego, because I feel like it's totally, I don't know, self-indulgent exercise, except that there's an artist who I really respect, Will, who finds this meaning in the sort of crappy films that I've been in, for the most part. You know, I think most people who were involved in them would recognize that they're not great works of art or great works of cinema. They have moments of okayness, and they fit into whatever commercial thing that they fit into, but they're not expressing consciously the intensity that an artist like Will is picking up off of them. Mm-hmm. And in a way that goes back, it's just like, it doesn't have to be a good song to be a good answer. You don't have to be in great films to have a through line and a sync thread and a sort of these resonant themes that show up. That's the nature of film. Film captures these moments, and moments, and in some ways, particularly in bad films, because bad films don't have as much control over what ends up on tape. Mm-hmm. And when you leave room for the flaw, when it's like asking the question and pushing shuffle function, when you allow something to accidentally initiate a situation, synchronicity happens. And when synchronicity happens, you are out of the normal temporal situation. You know, you're time traveling.
Yeah, you called cinema a psychedelic medium in your book.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's full immersion. It changes it makes you think that you're in a dream. And then there are these other aspects of if you record yourself and a lot of people watch, or someone else records you and a lot of people watch it, then a lot of people are projecting their consciousness onto the sacred artifact of your body, which lives outside of who you actually are. It's the thing that's on tape and part of someone else's fantastical vision.
Do you think there are producers, directors, actors that are conscious of this capacity to change the reality of the viewer, and they're consciously doing that?
Precious few, and I hope they're listening. I've been waiting for you all my lives. I've been preparing. I think some do. I'll tell you, for myself, I couldn't have put this into words before encountering the sync community. And even if I could, I would never have dared utter them, because it would sound so delusional. Like all of these films, these crappy films that I played little roles or big roles or but all just sort of like, I don't know, there's no through line. And I can say, well, there is a through line. I don't know how or some, but there's some way that it feels like every film I walk out of, that same character, he puts on a different cloak or a different something, but he walks into the next film and it feels like there's this through line. Like, I'm not bigger than the films, but in some way I am. And I would say every actor is. It's just like everyone is a god, a creator god in their own reality. And also everyone's just some schmo who I don't want to have anything to do with. You know, or I do want to have something to do with, but you know what I mean? Not mm-hmm. like everyone is on the periphery of the godhood and everyone is at the center of it. But from their, you know, from your own standpoint, I hope if you are living your life, you're at the center of the godhood of your life. And that includes me. You know, but it might not. And in a lot of cases, it doesn't. And that's, you know, that's the nature of the crazy making nature of Sync is that, you know, and especially you add in movies, which have a particular power to them. It does get confused. It's very weird to be a loser movie star.
Let me read some more from your book. You say, synchronicity expands the possibilities while cutting off most of the psychological escape routes. Once we realize that the world as we experience it is singing our reflections back at us all the time, it makes it very hard to blame anyone else for our predicament, or for that matter, to deny our own power, although most of us still try. So have you discovered what it is that makes this process of mirroring ourselves back happening?
Explain. I don't understand the question.
Well, you're saying that there's this kind of, the universe is singing our reflections back to us all the time. Do you know what it is that's making that process happen?
No, that's detective work. I'm not. I'm fully in the. I think of synchronicity as an art form that that empowers the listener. I can come up with a bunch of different theories. And the really fun thing about encountering the Sync book crowd and reading one of the Sync books is that you get so many different takes on Sync as a phenomenon.
Yeah, I like to hear those because some of them are pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah, they're all. I mean, you can. It's like Room 237 for people who've seen it. I think that Room 237 is the most important film in the realm of Sync film that has happened yet. And the reviews of it are usually, oh, well, you hear these people and some of their theories are just batshit crazy about The Shining. And some of them are interesting. And, oh, it's worth watching. You know, but in the sort of like, but they make it sound like it's a reality film where you're laughing at the batshit crazy idea of these conspiracy theorists. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I agree with every interpretation. But the point of a movie like Room 237 isn't to really unravel the mystery of Kubrick's film. I mean, it's to say that Kubrick created a mystery that he wanted us to unravel, that engages a kind of a part of our thinking, which is now, you know, was ahead of its time, is very, very Sync-y, you know, and it lends itself to lots of interpretations. And, you know, just like we can say that, like, a bad song can give you a good answer, and bad movies can still reveal awesome syncs. Great movies can as well, you know, in The Shining or Citizen Kane or, I don't know, we can make Rosemary's Baby. There are a lot of very syncy, you know, Wizard of Oz, super syncy films that are great pieces of cinema and are like the, you know, are, well, bringing it back to the question, to your question, it's like, I kind of think we create our own universe and we're all doing it accidentally. So it's like, it's very weird. It's a very weird universe we live in, very contradictory. But if we were, then we would create, you know, the Archons are Jim Carrey. The Archons are the, you know, these resonators that we project consciousness onto and then sit and have our communal dream to. And that, in a way, controls us and feeds off of us because we pay money for it. We pay our attention to it. I'm not saying that the other one, that there aren't actual beings that are doing that. But in a way, if beings are doing that, we've created a fantastic metaphor for it in our media. We create these gods that feed very well off of our attention.
We keep them alive by believing in them, talking about them all the time.
Right. And even not. And that's the power of film. That was the case when it really was about the spoken word or the live theater or the live performance. But the thing about, like, say, an actor like myself, if people continuing to care was what kept you alive, then I would probably be dead now. Because I've gone through periods where people don't really care. But something about the power of film has meant that these moments were recorded and could be drawn up. Like, there's a film that I did with Jennifer Jason Leigh called The Prom that was directed by Steve Schoenberg, who directed Secretary. It was a student film, and it has not been available forever. And then just this last year, it was available. It became available on the web. Someone just posted it. And all of a sudden, this thing that I did back in 1990, which was actually one of the few really good things I've done as an actor, all of a sudden became available and was alive again. Because no one could have cared about it before because no one could have seen it. But the power of film is that we can time travel back to that. And Will Morgan does that very well in the first installment of the film, his synxploration of my film career called The Sacred Kind. And he does something pretty awesome with this film called The Prom in it. I never know how far down the rabbit hole to go. So you interrupt
well, you
me.
Mentioned, well, yeah, you mentioned something about our body and being a time machine, which you get into in the book. And I thought that was interesting as well. You talk about memory as a kind of time travel. Can you get into that a little bit?
Well, absolutely. Everyone knows this experience. You know, if you have this, you can draw up a memory that affects your body. And it is a real experience. And we have that capacity. You could look at that as like an underused capacity. I mean, we spend a lot of time looking at other people's memories or our communal memory on screen. And I think that probably saps our capacity. But even at low capacity, I think everyone who's ever lived knows what it's like to be transported back to another time. And it's fleeting. But it is, it's sort of like the latent expression of what makes us dream of time travel. I mean, why do we dream of time travel? Because we have memory. If we didn't have memory, we wouldn't want to create time travel. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't fantasize about it, right? Because we'd be just in the constant now.
True.
And I'm not even sure if this is how I described it in my book, but it is sort of how I described it in my book because I'm just exploding. It's really fun to talk with someone who's read the book.
Liked how you talk about emotional work done at the level of memory has the capacity to change an individual's future. And I feel that as well.
Absolutely. How does that resonate for you?
Yeah, and then you say, well, by reintegrating whatever was lost in the undistinguished experience and allowing the time traveler to go forward as a slightly or radically different person. So for me, it thinks of times, I wish I redid that or said that different or did that experience different. If I do it in my head and I'm really convicted of it, it's like I've done the work. I know some people do meditation work and try and undo the past that way, try and unravel some of those kinks. I think it's possible.
I think that's what a lot of artists are doing. I think that's what, I mean, a lot of ways art is a way of taking a situation where you were powerless, reclaiming it and owning it in a way and being able to be the God creator at the center of it and make it, even if it still doesn't go the way that you wanted it to, you get to tell it in the way that you want it heard, and that reclaims it. I think that's the artistic impulse. And I think, in a way, I keep bringing it back to Cinque, because one of the things I write about in my book is honor among men. I put that at the heart of my tree. And one of the things that I really feel like, you know, I end up here on this wonderful show through the auspices of the Cinque Book crowd, and I feel like I want to keep sort of tossing the ball back to them because I do feel like the work they're doing and that we're doing in the realm of Cinque is kind of taking this in a way that my father's dream seminar is taking the work that we're talking about going back and reintegrating painful memories or things like that and healing and coming out the other side I think probably you've had other people on your show who probably talk about that. And I've certainly encountered a lot of teachers who talk about that. But one of the things that my father was about and Radio 8 Ball is about and the Cinque community is about and just artists and art in general are about is like, but it's fun. You know, that's one of the things that the healing aspect sometimes misses. And I think it misses it to its detriment because I don't think you can heal as much working hard at it as you can having fun at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like what you're reading about. There's no escape routes in the realm of Sync. Well, if you cut off all escape routes, so you're going to have to face the fact that you're an idiot on some level.
Yeah, that same thing's going to keep hounding you until you just start cracking up. Okay, already.
Right. But then have fun with it. Because, you know, again, if you put it into the realm of these archetypes, you know, that okay, so you're the fool. Big deal. You know, great. That's one of the best cards in the, you know, what our card was Ruin. And we're both pretty good, you know, Sync surfers, so we didn't make that into something dreadful and horrible, but mm-hmm. you could. But the Fool card, if that's who you are, if that's where you find yourself, that's like the best place to be. But, a lot of us are very, you know, it's one of the things that is the most frightening to most people, is to be the Fool. You know, everyone wants to be Jim Carrey because they think he makes a lot of money. And he does. But no one really wants to be that guy. No one wants to be, like, or they would. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to be that much of a goofball and always fall down, you know, and do it gracefully.
I'm sure he has his somber moments as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure. But his job is to be that archetype for us.
Mm-hmm.
He does.
No, go on. What were you
going to
say?
No. I was going to say, I just think he does. Yeah, he does the tears of a clown thing really well. He does it very well. And he's another guy. I feel like I'm my holy Moses. I'm on the periphery of him. The guy who directed Ace Ventura in Liar Liar is a director named Tom Shadyac, who your audience may be aware of because he did this great film called I Am. And he was my acting coach, and I write about him in the book Accidental Initiations. He was one of my big accidental initiators, and that was right before he went on to, you know, to launch Jim Carrey into the stratosphere. And again, it's this thing of like, wow, it's just like a volcano, like sprouting up right over the, like right across from my apartment. You know, just like having the tree emerge in my life in Accidental Initiations.
Is he the one who told you that our bodies can't tell the difference between a imagined experience and the real thing?
Absolutely. Your reading comprehension is marvelous.
I took notes.
Yes, he is the one who said that. And he got that, I'm sure, from Sandy Meisner or whoever taught him his Sanford-Meisner technique, which is what we were studying. And for those of you who are actors or are familiar with acting, the Sanford-Meisner technique is the ultimate in sync acting techniques, and it's part of what made me the great actor that I am not, because it made me have to leave Hollywood and do a lot of craziness that took me out of the game, but made me, you know, from the outside of our temporal game, this is the thing I've been learning from Will Morgan's films, is that the life I'm leading now is still informing the films that I did back when I did them. Because again, that's the nature of film, is that they capture everything. And not just me, probably everyone in it are still affecting these films. And in a weird way, because they're bad and unseen, it's easier for us to affect them. I know that sounds so crazy. We live at like the sync crowd. We are like, it is this, I think sometimes I like to think of it as the beat poet, but it's crazier than that. And none of us are probably as good writers as that. But, you know,
so are you pretty much every day looking out for syncs at this point?
No, I take sync for granted. Every day it's more like, I spend most of my day addressing the way that people have to deal with sync when they come into my orbit. Every time I call someone, they're like, oh, it's so weird. I was just thinking about, you know, that's sort of what you focus on, you attract. And my connection to sync is very, very pure. It comes through my father, and it has come accidentally. And, you know, so it might just be that I notice it all the time. I take it for granted. It's sort of like, you know, do you live your day looking for air or, you know, people? They're around. We live around air and people, and we live around sync. Actually, we are constantly syncing. And then occasionally, you know, and more occasionally, if you pay attention to it, you encounter other people who you get to recognize that with.
Yeah.
And that
there was a time Henrik and I were having a lot of food sinks for some reason. It was getting pretty ridiculous. Like anytime we'd sit down and watch something, if we were just eating something or about to have something, it was like it came up in the movie or the show for some reason.
Wow, powerful. Yeah. Well, that's that would be like a really powerful third chakra sink where, you know, the stomach. You know, I don't know where you were in your relationship, but that would be a kind of thing. I'm sorry, I'm just interpreting it for myself.
Yeah, that's fine. Go for it.
But if it was me and I was in a relationship and that was what we were having, it would be this thing of like, wow, we're making a home together, and that's a powerful energy to engage when you merge, like merging second chakra. People are doing that all the time. And in a weird way, through art, we get to merge our upper chakras in a lot of ways. But one of the most intimate mergings is that third chakra, to merge the belly, the primal influence and the primal will to, you know, to feed and be fed and to be.
And think about it. What do humans do when they get together? We always eat. There's always food involved.
And like everything, it applies to everything else, too. So, you know, there's a third third chakra aspect of all of the other chakras. There's a hungry eating aspect of our hearts. You know, we got to watch out for that. Well, we got to watch out for all of those, but also engage them because it can be really powerful.
Yeah. So I have to ask you a question. Why do Jewish mystics say that 40 is the ideal age to begin to study the Kabbalah? What is it about 40?
Again, I, not being a detective, I can't answer the question.
Oh, but you're Jewish. I thought you would know.
I will answer it. I will answer it experientially. Is that I, as a pretty non-practicing Jew, who grew up in a very non-Jewish town, found myself. But as one of my teachers, Greenway, I think probably said it in my book, and he inspired me to think this way, I'm really straight with the medicine. Whatever the medicine is, if it's Buddhism, if it's the Terence McKenna, if it's the, you know, whatever, I try and take it for what it is. And so I'll tell you that my personal experience was, I found myself in a class when I was 40, having a Kabbalah class that cost a lot more money than I could afford, being basically thrown at my feet right after my 40th birthday by a teacher who I really respected, with people who were strangely sync attracted to me. And in the first class, they said, well, you know, this is usually taught to people when they're 40 and only men. Only Jewish men when they're 40. And I was like, well, I'm glad we're not doing it that way because that's oppressive. But on the other hand, in my case, it's totally true. And my experience was that I don't know what everyone else got out of it, but I wouldn't have wanted, in a weird way, I wouldn't have wanted to know what I found out there any earlier. But at the same time, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, I like having lived 40 years of my life ignorant of that tree and being just drawn to it in ignorance, and then being able to have the next 40 years of my life to consciously work it as someone who's tending it for its contribution to future generations rather than mining it to fill myself, which is what my life was about before I was 40. It was really about, and I think everyone should be in a kind of way. It's like filling yourself. Fill yourself up. Fill, fill, fill. There's so much in life you don't know. Take it in. Let it make you, you know, and use it. Become powerful. But at a certain point, it shifts. There's something energetically that shifts. And it's like, okay, well, the most powerful thing now is to make other people powerful because they're going to be around and you're not, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm a young, old person. And I discovered Kabbalah right at the beginning of that shift. And so in answer to your question, I don't think it's a rule that is, I think it's an oppressive rule. And at the same time, it probably is a good rule. At least in my life, it was.
Maybe it's when you get certain things out of your system, then you have the focus and the concentration, or maybe you're ready to hear certain things at that point. I think it's interesting, though, to also live your life and be naive to a lot of things and then look back and analyze yourself, how you handled those things when you didn't understand certain principles.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's half the fun of being an artist, is creating things that remind you, like these little talismans to remind you, or just like if you or someone writes a journal and goes back and checks it. It's fun to go back and see where you were. And if you're an artist, you get to do that in an interesting way. You're kind of, your audience is your future self. Like if you can attain it, if you can entertain your future self, then you are a truly successful artist.
I think too, looking back, at least for my life, a lot of my biggest weaknesses are actually my biggest strengths. I just didn't know how to harness and use them yet, so they were taken advantage of all the time. And now I understand what they are, and I'm using them in a different way now that I'm 34.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. There's a song of mine that has that number in it, but that would be a tremendously obscure rabbit hole to try and squeeze into, which right towards probably the end of our show.
That's right. Well, if you can, please tell everyone about your websites, book, etc.
Right now, radio8ball.com is down, but the Indiegogo site that I use to raise the funds to fix the radio8ball.com, which will be back in August, is at radio8ball.com. And there are some really interesting videos there. I'd recommend checking it out. It's a nice little retrospective of Radio 8 Ball until we actually get the website back up. My book is called Accidental Initiations. It's available from Sync Book Press. If you go to accidentalinitiations.com, you'll find my blog, which was written as the sequel to the book. I encourage you to read the book before the sequel, and the links to the book, to buy, purchasing the book, are available at accidentalinitiations.com. I'm on Facebook. I encourage you to become a fan or a friend of me or Radio 8 Ball, particularly Radio 8 Ball. I post all kinds of interesting things there. I'm at Radio 8 Ball on Twitter. And I feel very honored to be on the show. And I also feel very, I just spewed and talked and talked and talked, but I figure that's what you got to do when you're being interviewed. But I do feel humbled by the invitation and by your attention to the book. And I wish we had 3 or 4 hours to talk about it, because I really would rather hear you talk about my book than hear me talk about my book.
Well, thank you so much, Anders. I appreciate it. And to everyone listening, ask a question, randomly pull a song, see what you can find. Right, Anders?
Absolutely. Do that. And, Come to Olympia and walk the tree. Honestly, if there's one point in my book, you don't have to. These are encoded. They're a reflection of our consciousness. You could probably find a walking labyrinth of a Kabbalistic tree of life somewhere near you. And if you can't, you can create. If you haven't, create one. Or come to Olympia and have some fun with the one that I found, because it's a blast. And I'd love to meet you.
I thought about leaving everyone with a song called Olympia by Hole, but instead I decided to pick something called Tree Fingers by Radiohead, which was released in the year 2000, which I know you said the year 2000 was something for you. It also makes me think of Conan O'Brien's In the Year 2000 skits. Do you remember those?
No, I'm sorry. I wish I could scat with you on that one. You threw it past me.
All right. Okay, well, thanks for listening, everyone, and thank you, Andres.
Thanks a lot.